Philippe.
Hello, my name is Iqbal Khan. I'm a theatre director. I directed Broken Glass.
Lovely, Iqbal. Welcome to Theatre Voice.
Hello.
So you directed Broken Glass, which is currently running in Kilburn Tricycle Theatre. It's had rave reviews.
It has had generally good, very, very good reviews, yes.
Yeah, but how did you get Anthony Scher to be involved in the production?
There was no magic about it. We sent him the script. I sent him the script because I was very interested in doing the part.
Mm-hmm.
And he read it, and he loved the play. Was obviously slightly uncertain about this Iqbal Khan director, and so asked to meet me. And so I went up to Stratford, met him at the Dirty Duck, and we sat and had lunch, and he asked about me, and I talked about me, and we both kind of identified with the outsider narrative in our lives, particularly in a theatre context. I think he warmed to me, and warmed to what I was saying about the play, and felt, I hope, confident that I could help him bring it to fruition. And he accepted very quickly after that. So it's a combination of the script and I hope a warming to me.
So Broken Glass is a very famous Arthur Miller play. It was done in the UK in 1994, but it hasn't been produced since then. Is that correct?
It has been produced. I think it was produced at the Bolton Octagon subsequently, but it's not been done in London since then. It premiered in America, I think in 1994, and then they developed the script, and the version that we have now, the published text, was the one that was premiered in 1994 at the National Theatre in a David Thacker production. And then it subsequently went on to a West End run, and then a film version was made with predominantly the same cast in 1996, and then that's it. You say it's a famous Arthur Miller play. What's shocking about it for me is that I don't think it is very well known. Even amongst theatre professionals. And it's shocking to me because I do think it is a late, great Arthur Miller play. In some senses, I think it's the most wonderful distillation of many of the concerns that he had in his life as a playwright and as a human being, as a political animal. It says so much, so elegantly. I felt it was an opportunity to try and make the case for the play, to make a broader case for the play again, to bring it into a more, popular awareness of the importance of this work.
So how did it work? Did you pitch the play to the Tricycle, or did they invite you to direct it?
It was kind of a synergy because Nick Kent approached me to do something there and asked me whether I knew any great Asian plays, at which I winced a little. Not because there aren't any great Asian plays, but because I don't like to be perceived in that way alone. I'm a director, and most of the work that I've done has not been Asian work at all. But I went to it and thought about it and came back with a number of suggestions. But one of the suggestions I came back with was Broken Glass. And the Tricycle had already been trying to get a hold of the rights for Broken Glass. So it was a meeting of two things. He then had to kind of be persuaded to allow me to direct Broken Glass, because obviously that's a big venture for them. And he had the courage to ask me to do it. So I'm very grateful to him.
So Broken Glass, of course, is like a period story. It's set in 1938, New York.
Mm.
It's got Anthony Scher in the lead as a kind of a very repressed Jewish guy who's trying to deny his own background.
Mm.
His wife gets a psychosomatic illness.
That's right. I suppose the inciting event in the play happens just before the play, 9 days before the play, when the wife, Sylvia Gelberg, collapses and loses the use of her legs, and is subsequently diagnosed by the doctor who's treating her, Dr. Harry Hyman, as having hysterical paralysis. Now, in a sense, the play has a sort of a thriller structure, in the sense that we're trying to discover what it is that might have caused that illness. The contributory factors seem to be significantly to do with, or more obviously to do with, reports of the atrocities happening, the obscenity that's happening in Germany at the time, Kristallnacht, etc., which in the play it's suggested has happened perhaps a few weeks ago. The reports are coming through in the papers, and there seems to be a generally sort of complacent reaction from the broader American public, and Sylvia's horror at events might have been a contributory factor, but there's also a sense that there are problems with marriage with her husband Philip Kjellberg, and Philip, as you say, is a Jewish businessman. He works in a mortgage broker's office. He's the only Jew that's ever worked there, and he's very, very proud of that. And he has a very complex relationship with his Jewish identity. He is, in some sense, he's ashamed of it, but at the same time, he lauds it over others that he is, in a sense, one of the most successful Jews around because he's assimilated so successfully. We learn as the play goes on that this man has a tendency to violence, sometimes against his wife. So he's not a very pleasant man from the very beginning. A man full of pride, full of resentment, perhaps full of self-loathing. But these things are revealed to us as it goes on. And the picture becomes deeper, darker, more intricate.
It has a lot of humour in it as well.
Yes, it does. Yeah. it does. I think Miller described it as a tragedy with great jokes. And that's pretty much what it is. He's very good, Miller, at particularly in this play, at allowing the humanity of characters, the collision of opposites, and finding and structuring the scenes in such a way that the humour comes out of that sort of collision of things. He doesn't really caricature anyone in this play. He's very good at finding humour in the extraordinary confrontations between extraordinary people. It is, I think, very, very funny. I'm not sure that was mined as much in the original incarnations of the play, because obviously there is this very serious background to the play, the Kristallnacht thing, the impending Holocaust. Our perception of that, I think, has made people kind of shy away, perhaps, from the broader humour in it. But I think that's a part of Miller's picture, a part of how he lets us into the humanity of people.
So the set that you had was it's very cinematic, but it's got these like light bulbs and broken glass everywhere, and you've got gauze. I mean, it's like as though it's got these depths, like a film type of a screen approach. But one very unusual facet of it I found was that there was a cello player interluding between every scene. Is that something that Miller wrote in the text?
Or? Yeah, that's a part of the structure of the piece. It's I don't think Miller's given credit for his experiments in form. I don't think it's enough to describe him as a naturalistic writer. I don't think he is. I think he's a poetic writer who deals with the real world, but has a poetic aesthetic when it comes to sort of constructing these plays, the form that he uses. And we can go back to Death of a Salesman, and that's obviously almost expressionistic in the way it deals with time. And in Broken Glass, it is quite, I mean, it is, the scenes themselves, I suppose, are quite straightforward in terms of the reality of them. But he structured the play with a cello solo strictly between every single scene. Which makes a director quite nervous, because your instinct or your impulse is to keep pushing the narrative forward, to never lose the tension of the thing. But Miller's imposed this structure, and I think he's done it for a very, very good reason, because there is such an intensity to those scenes. There's so much information in the scenes. The cello solos almost act as a kind of moment for the audience to reflect on that which has gone before and to prepare for that which is to come. And the way I've approached the cello solos is not necessarily to write music that is scene change music or that is mood music. I've tried to make them dramatic events in and of themselves.
So yeah. What was the choice of music that you used for the play itself?
Well, it's all original music. A composer called Grant Olding and I worked together on the tone of it. One of the things I didn't want to do with the play was to overlay it too much with a Jewish sensibility. It's also a play that's about America at a certain time. Because I thought that if one does that with our knowledge of what subsequently happened post 1938, this would be seen as a sort of a Holocaust play, and that when that theme would dominate our response to everything that goes on, and I think that would be a distortion of the play. So I wanted to try and make me and Grant were trying to have music that spoke more broadly, that spoke more abstractly to the concerns in the play. And in terms of how we've used it in the design, we do...
Who was your designer for the set?
Mike Britton. Yes, it was Mike Britton. And again, I suppose we've gone for quite an expressionistic design set. It's very simple, though. And again, part of the reason for that was that I thought it important that we not get lost too much in the clutter of the real world. That this was a play about confrontations, about archetypal confrontations.
But it's also about people. It's about a marriage, really, isn't
That's
it?
Right. And I suppose the design really focuses us much more on those people. And their concerns, and any element of set becomes symbolic.
But you've got a very fine cast within the piece.
I think it's an extraordinary cast. Yes.
Was it all? Did you pick your cast, like the doctor Nigel Lindsay, for example, and the wife who's played by Lucy? Did you pick your
Yes,
actors?
I did. I had meetings with them all, most of them I think hadn't read the play before. Obviously knew of Arthur Miller, but had, once reading the play, had a few reservations perhaps about the tone of the piece and how it would work. But we met and we talked, and I think all of them chose to do it for the right reasons, which is because they were excited by the idea of realizing this extraordinary play.
Okay, but just before we forget, we have been talking about the cellist, but we didn't really name her.
Laura Moody is her name.
And is that someone you've worked with before?
No, it isn't. Again, she's an extraordinary artist in her own right. She's performed in a theatre troupe that uses stringed instruments, I think a quartet, that makes theatre out of that sort of music. She's also performed with bands. I think she's just finished a tour with Peter Gabriel. But has also performed in a classical context as well. She's and in a lot of modern musical context, which is very useful for us because that's more the aesthetic sensibility that we were using. So she's very, very gifted and also has a great sensitivity to what goes on in a dramatic event, in a theatre event. And she collaborated enormously with Grant because this is the first thing that Grant's ever written for a cello. And she was tremendous at allowing us to find other colours and other ways of using the cello, much more than just to do with melody, but also to do with textures of sound, etc.
Of course, we're sitting here at the National in a quiet space in the foyer, and you've got a relationship with this...
A relatively quiet place in the foyer.
Well, at the moment, yes. No, I just wanted to ask you about your own journey in theatre. I mean, the last time I saw a play of yours, it was here, which was Rafta Rafta by Ayub Khan Din.
Yes,
so can you tell Theatre Voice a little bit about how you got involved in theatre?
I was involved in theatre quite a while before me and the National finally managed to work together.
Actually, I met a lady called Paula at Kilburn Tricycle, and I remember seeing her in your production of Othello that was on at the Leicester Haymarket many years ago. You have to give me her full name, though.
Paula Jennings.
Yes, yeah.
Right. Well, I started life sort of in my 18, in my late teens, wanting to be a mathematician. Right. And actually, probably more serious about becoming a professional cricketer than anything else. Went to Trinity College, Cambridge, to study the maths tri-pass. I was then very ill there, and that sort of ruined my cricket ambitions. But I then had to degrade for a year because of my illness, which means taking the year off. And I had clinical depression for a year as well because of my illness, and it made me reflect on everything. And on why I was doing and what I wanted to do with my life, and I sort of found that that maths, although I loved it, and theoretical physics, which is where I'd seen myself going, I was doing it more to impress others in my life, I'd always been brought up with my brothers with a love of literature, language, poetry, theatre, music, the arts, I had the opportunity potentially to have either done maths or English at university. Now, you know, at the time I thought English was not as useful a subject to do at university as maths was. I sort of regret that now, and I never did theatre at university, but during my clinical depression, I had some voice problems, and I saw a voice therapist, and she suggested that when I went back to university, that I should do some drama. Now, I'd done drama when I was younger, but the minute I had puberty, and there was the possibility of kissing girls, that wasn't
that was the reason why you did it.
Coming from an Islamic background, that was complex.
Oh.
Now I had a medical reason to go back and to do some drama. Not to kiss girls, obviously. I was more serious-minded than that. So I went back and I did a production. I auditioned for a production of Twelfth Night. Got the priest, and so I had a lot of time to sit in a rehearsal room and listen. And I found it extraordinary. It was like a Damascene conversion. It was for me the perfect model of how people should be with each other in this world. I perhaps wouldn't articulate it in that way then. I just found it electrifying. And immediately, I have no idea why, but wanted to direct their next production. And I suggested to them Pinter's The Homecoming. And so I directed that and took it to the Edinburgh Festival. I then acted in it when one of the actors fell ill, and then did both acting and directing for 2 or 3 years.
While you were at university?
While I was at university and immediately afterwards, because I ran a venue at the Edinburgh Festival on Prince's Road, and would produce, direct, and act in things. So I was obsessed.
So you just decided that you must go to Edinburgh. That seemed the logical place to take a play.
Well, it was a convenient way for it to happen, because Imperial College, which is where I was then, because I'd gone back and done physics, and that's what I started doing. They were doing theatre. They had a venue there that they could use to take place, and so I took that homecoming up to Edinburgh and fell in love with that world.
And what about the Twelfth Night? Did you do that at Cambridge or at...
Oh, no, that was at Imperial.
So, you gave up on Cambridge and moved to Imperial to study...
I did physics at Imperial, and ultimately gave up my course because I had 1 year to go, potentially, but I was so aching to get out there and to do what I needed to do. Could feel the depression coming on again, and so I made the decision to make it in the world as an actor, director, much to the horror of my mother and my brothers. My brothers understood my passion and encouraged it, actually, but they also perhaps understood the stupidity of not taking one more year and getting the degree, and they, how useful that might be. But I've done a lot of stupid things in my life, for the right reasons, I hope. So I did that, and then for a while, I tried to make it as an actor. I did a 1 year postgraduate course at a place called the Academy in Whitechapel, and they did something that was called the company course, which is basically a repertory season for a company of actors, and you work with potentially 9 professional directors, and you do 2.5 weeks rehearsals, and you put the play on for a week, and it was a tremendous accelerated learning curve for me, both as an actor and as a director. And then subsequently after that, when I tried to make it as an actor, my interest was always in classical theatre. I particularly Shakespeare. I loved Shakespeare. I love Ibsen, Chekhov, etc. And Arthur Miller, actually. That was when I wanted to be as an actor. And at that time, now we're talking maybe 15 years ago, saying to an agent, and I was quite sort of militant with agents then. I would say that I refused to play corner shop packies. Because I knew that was where the work was in TV, and that my ambitions were to work in theatre and in a certain kind of theatre, and I could just feel the shutters coming down. I don't think that's the way the world is now. I think it's quite the opposite now, but it was the way it was then, and I got very, very, very dissatisfied and frustrated by it, and decided to set up my own theatre company and to direct my own plays. Now I found it very hard to make the national theatres of this world I come across a lot of 20-something-year-old directors now who are accepted for interviews, get bursaries, etc. At that time, for me, it was very, very hard. I had nothing on my CV that would really lend to anything. If I'd been met, I would have maybe impressed, but it was very hard to get anybody to meet me. And it was actually Marion Elliott, to whom I wrote a letter, who just decided, because she liked the tone of the letter, to meet me in London. She then suggested I come for interview at the Exchange.
Marion Elliott is, exactly?
Marion Elliott was at the time one of the 4 artistic directors at the Royal Exchange in Manchester. I think she's now an associate at the National Theatre. But she's a director, a theatre director.
So did you grow up in Manchester or
no,
something?
No, I was based in London, but I sent letters out to all the artistic directors asking for experience, asking for any opportunity to observe, to learn, to do. And Marianne found the letter, received my letter, invited me for an interview.
So you were like born and brought up in London then? Were you a Londoner?
I was born in Birmingham.
Right.
And then when I came to Imperial, I moved to London. So when I was about 20, and then I've been in London essentially since then. So Marion Elliott invited me to come to interview for an assistant director bursary at the Exchange. Now, it's a very significant moment for me, because I went there knowing what I knew, having done a number of productions on the fringe here with my own company, and played parts like Othello, Prospero, Hamlet. I'd done quite a bit in my own way, but went to this meeting, and there were these 4 artistic directors there at the other side of this extraordinarily long table, and I'd never felt so impoverished in my life. I'd never felt so unentitled to be in this profession, and I completely froze. I think Marianne was quite shocked at how little I said in that interview, and when I left depressed, and she came and talked to me outside afterwards. She wanted to understand why, and I couldn't articulate it for her in the moment. I suppose I could have gone one of 2 ways then. I could have just been completely dissuaded and persuaded myself that this was not the thing for me, and that maybe I should go back to science, etc. But actually, it angered me enormously, because I had let myself down. It was to do with all the things that I was imposing on myself through them. I mean, they weren't particularly awful to me. They were lovely, in fact. It was me. It was the my own issues. And so I decided to do an MA in theatre directing. Now, the minute I did that, the minute I decided to give myself a year where I didn't have to do any other work to sustain me while I did my theatre project, the minute I did that, things changed very, very quickly for me. I did an MA in theatre directing at the Middlesex University. And then during that MA, I directed two operas with semi-professional groups in London. And I got an Arts Council bursary to go and work at the Leicester Haymarket Theatre. So I came out of the MA and went immediately onto that. And then really, since then, I haven't stopped working. And I've been, I directed an Othello there in their studio, a very successful one.
Which is where Paula Jennings comes
which
in.
Which is where Paula Jennings, Paula Jennings and I met as actors a few years before that, but I directed her as Amelia in it. And The original idea was just to have a black Othello and everyone else was Asian and Amelia was white. So the two others in the world of the play are actually black and white, because I wanted to look at sort of what the play's exploration of racism as more an interrogation of what it is, of how the indigenous population respond to the other, to broaden it. And actually, I mean, I know that there's enormous racism in the Asian community toward black people. So I wanted to investigate that in Leicester. So that was an incredibly rewarding experience. And subsequently to that, I've been directing all over the country in regional theatres and abroad in Japan. I spent a year in Japan because I had a bursary to train there for a year, a fellowship to train there for a year. I've been working. I mean, when it comes to the national, they gave me two opportunities to come here and be a staff director, and I couldn't take them because I was directing elsewhere. And I'd always told myself that if ever I was directing, I wouldn't. I would never take any kind of assistant job, no matter how that might speed up the process of getting into the institutions of theatre. I was more interested in just doing the work. But when I came back from Japan, I felt a need to accelerate things and to engage much more with London. And Nick Heitner rang me up and asked if I would be interested in potentially being staff director on Rough the Rough Start, the first production of it here. And so I went in to be interviewed by him, and he liked me, we got on, and I then was staff director on the first production of that at the National, and then directed it on tour. And then subsequent to that, directed a double bill of Pinter plays here with Simon Russell-Beale and Claire Higgins, and which was, I think, the final sort of major rehearsal room in which Pinter himself was involved. That was an extraordinary experience. It was extraordinary working with Simon and Claire, and it was thrilling to have that conversation, those conversations, and that relationship with Harold.
Yes, you were very privileged to have met him, really.
Yeah.
Can I just clarify for the Theatre Voice listeners, I'm assuming you didn't get that bursary in the Exchange Manchester?
No, I didn't. Right, no, okay. No, I didn't. Absolutely not.
And what was the name of your company that produced you?
It was called Liberal Tongue Productions.
Liberal Tongue.
Yes.
Right, lovely. And then, of course, you've talked of being a staff director on a production. I mean, what's that like? And then directing the show on tour, something like Rough the Rough Start. Do you have to follow a model, as it were?
To a certain degree. I mean, there's a production in place. I suppose I had an opportunity in the sense that we had recast some things. And Nick was very generous. He gave me free rein to develop it. In any way that I saw fit, and so there was an element of development that happened in taking it out on tour.
There was some talk of the production touring America. Did that happen at all?
I think there was it. I don't think the production toured, but there was a production of it in America by an American company.
I see.
I haven't really assisted very much in my life, so I think I've assisted only twice ever in my life, because I've always directed, and I'd heard various things about Nick and Nick Heitner's process in a rehearsal room, but I found him very generous. I mean, serious-minded. I don't think he suffers fools gladly, but he was very, very generous to me in all the time that I was here, and I'm extremely grateful to him. And I think he has a very, very enlightened approach to the sort of work and the sort of people that work at the National Theatre.
So, of course, you winced earlier when you were talking about when you were approached with Nicholas Kent, who said, "Have you got any plays by any Asian writers?" Because you didn't want to pigeonhole yourself in that category. I just wondered, do you have any reflections on the kind of state of, you know, Asian theatre in the UK or our relationship with the mainstream theatre as embodied in a play like Rafta Rafta, for example, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that with Rafta Rafta, it was an adaptation of an existing play, an existing successful, well-made play, a northern play.
All in Good Time.
All in Good Time, yes. Which is very clever, in a sense, to find a connection with a broader sensibility. Now, in terms of the original work that's coming out of the Asian theatre companies, and there are too few of them, and I'm not sure that they're understood as well as they should be by the institutions. The larger institutions, I mean, the National Theatre included, the Arts Council. I'm not sure their ambitions are understood. I'm not sure whether they are supported specifically enough. I think there is still constant hoop jumping that goes on. And for these companies to really develop, they sort of need to be given permission to fail, and fail spectacularly. They need to be given confidence in the fact that they can work for the next 3 or 4 years, knowing that they have funding, and knowing that they can just, you know, construct their own vocabularies of performance. And it seems to a lot of the theatre companies, the Marchais was an example, for instance, that do fantastic work, but are constantly pressured by the end,
they're sort of judged on the end product, you're exactly. saying, rather than the process, as well.
Yeah, and just not being given the. I mean, I think a lot of things that they have to do have to be justified on so many different levels, and a lot of them economic, and that's hard. That's very, very hard, and it's a shame that those artists, for instance, aren't employed more within places like the National Theatre, a subsidised theatre, which allows them to perhaps experiment, to construct work outside of the precarious world of their own theatre companies, but in a safer institution, to just give voice and to explore completely independently what it is they might want to explore, and not to have to satisfy any arts council criteria. It's very hard for artists to genuinely develop in that context. I'm not sure how authoritative I can be about this, but my observation is that I'm disappointed by the lack of genuinely serious Asian playwriting voices out there,
You mean in the sense of the big ideas type
the
story?
The big ideas, yeah. Big ideas, and also in terms of experiments and form, it just doesn't seem to be happening in the same way and at the same rate as others. But I suppose that's also a reflection of. Where the generally the sort of Asians in theatre are in terms of the evolution of their involvement in it. I mean, I think the black involvement was earlier. Black actors are now much more experienced. They've been working in the industry for longer, and so in a sense, I think they're about 5 years ahead in that sense. Just in terms of the broad pool of acting and writing talent, and I suppose there is still that evolution going on with Asian actors and Asian writers. I'm just not. I just think there seems to be more of a constricted sense of what Asian writers particularly are expected to produce And I think it's a shame that, for instance, the big play here that dealt with migration, identity, ultimately with sort of...
You mean the Richard Bean thing?
Was written by Richard Bean. That there wasn't, or there wasn't a collaboration perhaps with an Asian writer as well.
But that was a pure farce that sort of upset everybody from all the different types of community groups. England people very nice.
England people very nice. Yeah, I thought it was its ambitions were more serious minded than that, and I know it upset a lot of people, and I'm not sure how successful it was ultimately, but I think it did have a very serious, ironic, satirical intention.
But do you think if you are sort of working in some way like a very big venue, then you have to do slightly stuff that is a bit more broader based? Which can appeal across the board rather than very nuanced and fine stuff.
I do think the opposite. I think in an institution like the National, and I think I really do think under Heitner this is the case, Nick Heitner, it's subsidised to experiment. It's not subsidised to make enormous profits. It's subsidised because there is a certain part of its work that is potentially minority interest, specialist interest, dangerous work, work that might economically fail, but is necessary in terms of artistic exploration, political exploration, etc. It should be a forum within which writers can go to more dangerous places.
But just to clarify, on the Rafter, that was just commissioned in-house because they thought, the National thought it would like to appeal to a diverse community, or did?
Well, I'm sure that they were looking for something that would appeal to a different kind of audience, that would develop relationships with other kind of artists, other kind of actors, another kind of writer, etc. So I'm sure that was a big part of it. But also, it's a very good play and a great idea to get Ayub to adapt it. And to work with him here, and it's a great popular formula.
No, I accept that, but I was just wondering, did the idea come from the National, or did Ayub suddenly think, oh, I'd love to adapt this?
I think the play came from initially from Nick Heitner. He's from Manchester, I think, and he was aware of the original play, and I think he put it under Ayub's nose, and I don't think he dictated that this was what needed to be done. But then I read it, and I think he'd known the play from his days in Bolton, and so there was a marriage of minds, I think, there. But I think the original idea for the play did come from Nick Heitner.
Well, we could carry on talking to you for ages. It's a very interesting conversation. I suppose what we must try and do at Theatre Voice is to have a conversation across the board with the kind of Asian theatre community and the mainstream to air some of these issues, especially the potential to be able to fail without being judged on those various tick-boxing sort of elements.
Absolutely.
What about yourself? What's next for you after Broken Glass?
Well, I mean, there's the ambition that potentially that Broken Glass might have another life, that it might transfer. I hope it does, because, I want it to be seen by as many people as could possibly see it. There's a case that needs to be made for this play. And then subsequent to that, there's lots of potential things. There's a one-man play that I'm directing for a company called Box Clever, which I've directed before, but which is touring again. And then there are various big meetings that I'm having about things that might happen in 2011. But at the moment, for the first time in my directing career, I'm not sure what's happening, which is an exciting place and a dangerous place to be, I suppose.
So, Iqbal Khan, thank you very much for talking to Theatre Voice.
So
thank you.